Fire Engineering Podcasts are sponsored by MSA. Firefighters want to be connected to each other, to dispatch, and to their commanders. MSA has created Lunar, a wireless, handheld device that includes thermal imaging, firefighter ranging, motion alarm, and cloud technology with GPS. It's part of the new connected firefighter platform from MSA. Learn more at msafire.com.
Welcome, everyone, to the debut episode of APS Radio on the Fire Engineering Network. My name is Jim Bernica. I'm typically the host of the 25 Life, which is a weekly health and wellness podcast. We'll be doing the same format here, but it's going to be on a monthly basis. It's going to be the third Friday of each month. My special guest this week is my old friend, Dr. Sarah Jahnke. So without further ado, let's bring Sarah in. Well, welcome everyone to the debut episode of APS Radio. I'm here with Dr. Sarah Jahnke, the smartest person I know, but can't figure out how to hook up her headphones to her computers.
It's one computer. Everyone has skills, and mine just happens to not be anything technology related.
40 minutes of my life, ladies and gentlemen, that I will never get back.
But I sang almost the entire time.
She knows that I just got off a 36-hour shift where I got beat up on the medic, and she knows I'm tired, and yet she drags me for an extra 40 minutes. So with that, I think we should just, yeah, thanks a lot. Let's just dive right into sleep deprivation in the fire service. How's that? Perfect segue.
I think that is a perfect segue. And I think that, I've been doing a lot of work around sleep and reading up a lot on sleep. And there's really no part of your body that is functioning optimally at this point in time. You said you had how many calls last night?
No, I had some calls. I had about a 2.5-3 hour window where I was left alone. But other than that,
yeah,
I was up.
That's not enough sleep. So fun fact. I actually do think this is a fun fact, but how much sleep do you think you need in a night?
7 to 9 hours.
Personally. Like, if you
I gave the answer I'm supposed to know. No, if I didn't know that, how about beforehand? Like, rewind Jim Bernica back from a couple of years.
Yeah.
And I would have probably said 6 hours is suffice.
Yeah. So you would think that, but it's actually not true. So there, you know how there people are like, oh, I can just go on 4 hours of sleep, right? Or I can go on 5 hours of sleep and I'm fine. So there is actually a gene. They've studied that to look if they call it the sleepless elite. And they've said, are there people who really truly don't fall asleep? Hello. You see the problem? It's not that boring yet. So there are people that are the sleepless elite that can go on less than the 8 hours. I'll just go for a while. I'll wake you up when I need another question. I can talk to myself for an hour. Don't worry about it. No, there are people who are sleepless elite that really don't need that much time. They found a gene. So they took a whole bunch of people who believed that they were sleepless elite, and they put them in a lab. And they let them, like, perfect sleep opportunity, you know, it was the perfect sleep environment, and they let them sleep as little or as much as they needed to. And there were people who believed they were sleepless elite who really did not, regardless of perfect sleep opportunity, all the time to sleep in the world, only slept like 4 or 5 hours and then functioned just as well as they would without it. So they found a gene that those people possess that they think is the reason that they're the sleepless elite. But you're more likely to be struck by lightning than to have that gene. Isn't that a fun fact?
That is a fun
fact. So most people, Yeah. So most people, because I'll do that when I present that places, I'll say, you know, how many people think that you need less than 5 hours a night to sleep? And there are always a few people in the room, and I'm like, I'm getting out of this room because that means lightning is about to strike. It's very rare. It's there, but it's very rare. But the challenge is, like, your sleep and lack of sleep affects everything about your cognition, the way you forget, the way you remember, all that kind of stuff.
It is amazing. I had this discussion at the firehouse just yesterday, and it was around the table. How many of us are taking testosterone shots?
What was the answer?
Half of us. Half of us were out of six. That means three.
50% right there. I can do math. So that's another, okay, so also tied in both with sleep and the way, like, you actually see people who are not getting enough sleep have more fertility issues, but then back to fertility issues and testosterone issues, fire service, that's one area that's getting a lot of focus and study right now. I know Denise Smith up at Skidmore has put in some proposals to look at that, because testosterone and well, on both sides, like any of the reproductive hormones, men and women, a lot of studies are being done on it just because it looks like it does affect. And is it sleep? Is it other exposures? Because there's risk of having too high of testosterone and too low of testosterone. Denise just put out a paper looking at the cardiac risks of not having the right levels of testosterone. It's really fascinating. But again, that goes back to sleep too, and how you're, so the sleep and the circadian rhythms and the way you, I'm like hand dancing on your show, but the circadian rhythms of like the REM and non-REM sleep, it really does regulate every system in your body. So if you think about like how interrupted, you didn't even probably get through two full cycles of sleep last night. So if you think of how interrupting those regularly affects every system in your body. Yeah,
And it's two nights in a row of that.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because people ask about shift. One of my least favorite questions is the impact of like a 48-96 and those types of questions. And one, there's just not great data out there, which is why, one of the reasons I hate having to do an educated guess on anything. But I think one of the challenges is when people talk about that, they'll talk about like, well, my department, it depends not just on how busy your department is, but how busy the busiest house and the busiest truck or medic unit or whatever at your department is. So that's what people have to think about is I think that when we first started studying this, because we actually did a couple of studies, we did one on excessive daytime sleepiness where we looked at the department level about what their shift was, their shift schedule. And actually it doesn't matter what your shift schedule is at the department level. You really need to look at the individual and how many times the individual is up a night. We did find that linking shifts, you know, and then there's overtime. Like we were talking about, one of the challenges is someone's got to be there to, you know, take care of grandma when she has a heart attack in the middle of the night or needs to be picked up off the bathroom floor. So someone's got to be up at night, but then it's like, you got to do what you can to mitigate that. Very best book recommendation. And I don't have it here, I don't think, next to me, but Why We Sleep by Dr. Walker out of California.
You didn't know that I come with props.
What?
I know.
Yes. Have you read it yet?
Not all the way through.
But it's good, right?
I'm all over the place with books and reading stuff.
I know. It's a challenge. But I tell you, finish reading that book and you will definitely, like, I totally changed my sleep afterwards. I changed how I prioritized it. Because I used to think, like, oh, I can get up early and work out because the benefit of working out outweighs the benefit of getting 8 hours of sleep. Does not look like that is the case.
Absolutely.
So, but interesting thing, there is a Joel Billings who's down working out of Florida now, but finished his dissertation in Oklahoma. He looked individually at people, and he actually looked at sleep opportunity and had some interesting findings around the time shifts started, and that might be a way that things could be adjusted to help. Because if you think about, like, if a shift changes at 7 a.m., you're always getting up early either to come into work or getting up early to leave work. So maybe altering the time that shift changes is beneficial. So I don't know, more data to come on that.
Do you have a recommendation on that? Remember?
So not, well, not a recommendation yet, but it does look like, I mean, what he was looking at with the data is if you had like a change at like 8 or 9, I mean, it depends on where you're at too, right? So there are a couple departments that have, well, I take that back. I can only think of one department I know that has like a noon shift change. And I don't know that it needs to be that extreme, but like, if you think about if it was an 8 or 9 o'clock, then you could sleep your full cycle in the morning before you get up to, you know, get all your stuff packed up and leave. And then you wouldn't have to, I mean, it depends. There's some places where, like, I know I've been to places where people drive an hour into work and almost everyone does, you know, for like out in LA County. I met people who flew in to LA County to work. So, I mean, that for them, an hour change isn't going to be different. But imagine if, like, what time did you get off?
7 a.m.
Yeah. Like, what if you'd gotten off at 8 or 9 and you were able to sleep in a little bit longer?
I mean, selfishly for me, the time works out to where I'm able to get home and tag my wife out and make sure I can get my oldest on the bus.
Yeah.
So it works now that way pretty good for us. But around here, there's 6 a.m. or 7 a.m. or 8 a.m. And yeah. I mean, that's just typical. And it works, and I think we're used to it. But kind of like what you were saying, it doesn't matter if I'm off and, you know, 1 or 2 days or off for a week, I'm still getting up around the same time I would at work every morning, mm-hmm. 5:15, 5:30. Regardless of if I have nothing to do, I'm still getting up because it's just that's that habit.
Isn't that frustrating?
Totally frustrating. Totally frustrating. Like the sometimes days, think, like, the days of my youth when I could sleep in until like 11 o'clock, you know, they're just so, amazing. They're gone. They're way gone. I don't know. Are you still there? Can you still hear me? She's having difficulties again with her mic. Smartest person I know can't handle a microphone.
I can't be the only person.
You're up there.
How about now?
I can hear you now.
I didn't even move. Like, I was just sitting here.
You have to stand or stay completely still during this show.
And you're gonna keep thinking I'm frozen. I wish I could talk without moving my mouth.
It's okay.
All right, I'm good. Sorry.
No, it's okay. It's sleep.
Yes.
I've seen it.
Do you see the cognitive slowing you have right now?
A little bit. Yeah. That's okay. We'll get through this and then I'll sleep and we'll be all right. Or I'll be all right.
So speaking of other sleep impacts, and I'm not going to ask you about when you were driving home this morning, but have you ever read or have you read in the book yet about micro sleeps? You're driving?
Just where you do like mini nodding off, kind of when you nod off.
Yes.
Like at a stop.
So
stuff, right?
So this is fascinating. You know how you'll be driving and you have like that moment and you just like, even like there have been times that I've nodded. I mean, okay. There have been times where I've nodded off while I was driving where I like knew that I fell asleep for a couple seconds, but even that like long blink where your body's trying to recover the sleep that you are missing. And those are called micro sleeps. And they can be like, it's only a couple seconds, but there have been some studies that compared micro sleeps because sleepy driving is one of the biggest car accidents, and they compared it to alcohol drunk driving. And they found that in a lot of ways, it was actually more dangerous because when you're drunk, you'll see something like your reaction time is slowed. And so you'll try to like steer, you know, you see that a car is coming on, you're kind of trying to steer off. What they find with micro sleeps is because your body totally paralyzes for those few seconds just to try to like grab on to some refreshment, people will hit straight on. And so a lot of the accidents that they see with drowsy driving are actually worse than accidents they see with drunk driving. So then imagine if you are both drunk driving and sleepy.
It's ugly. I've got about a 15 minute. Go ahead. Sorry.
I just was going to say, I want to be clear, I'm not advocating that people should drunk drive.
No, I don't think anybody took it that way.
Right,
and definitely don't drink and drive as you're tired. That was the take home point. That was the take home point.
That's the take home point. But also, don't drive drunk.
No.
Get an Uber. I like a walking public service announcement today. Yeah. Uber is brilliant.
Ever since that became more readily available, I can tell you, at least on our department, the DUIs, the accidents are way down compared to when I started 20 years ago. So that's a good thing.
Yeah, it is. It is. Although that's a good lead into the stuff we're doing on alcohol use too. When we did a study of the, this was in the Midwest, it was like 23 departments, but about 10% of the 799 firefighters we surveyed said that they had driven drunk in the previous 30 days.
That's
about half reported, and about half had reported binge drinking in the last 30 days. That's a lot. It would be interesting to go do that now, though, and ask, given Uber and all that kind of stuff, and see if that number's lower. I'll look at that in their latest data.
That's much more convenient for the kids these days. I'm calling them kids because I'm old.
Kids.
You know, they're able to get on that, and it's no big deal. I mean, that's just kind of their part of the whole going out thing now.
Well, not right now, but in general.
Yes. Thank you. Yeah, that was not an option back then. You know, I mean, it was because calling a taxi was, I don't know. That was just.
Yeah.
It was.
You would do the designated driver. That always worked out well.
It worked. I was that. I've been that before.
Yeah.
But the worst part about that is being sober and dealing drunks. Right.
It's not really a lot of fun hanging out with a bunch of drunks if you're not drunk with them.
No.
But then the designated driver has to also actually stay sober, which is a problem.
I was part of that alcohol survey that you were doing. And I think I was early on to where I was one of your test subjects. Like just to see how the questions related.
Oh. Yeah. I thought you meant you were early on where like we went out and drank a lot, which I think did happen too, but I think that is a different thing. That was different. That was more like field work, case study type stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was a long time ago. Anyway,
so 16 months ago.
Yeah. Anyways, no, but I got this call and they're going through all these questions and making sure they're relevant to ask all these other fire departments. I was again the kind of the guinea pig, and I felt like when I was talking to the individuals on the phone, and it wasn't necessarily like I wasn't going over my personal experiences, but I was just being involved in the department, being a peer supporter, and just seeing a lot of interesting things with firefighters over the last couple decades. I don't think they were ready. I don't think they had any clue about firefighters and alcohol and how it works. Because it's to the point with some of these firefighters that they're able to go on shift, not have any alcohol during that shift and function completely, you know, fine, do well. Nobody has any idea. And then those, that time off, as soon as they get off, they can hit the bottle and then just repeat.
Hit it hard.
Yes.
So that was what I find really interesting. And I had a hard time. So we have the team that's working on that alcohol project includes the lead of it is really well known in the alcohol research world. But what's interesting is he kept going back to, okay, so like for job related incidents and the job, and I'm like, from early on in the qualitative stuff and just from personal experience, you know, I was like, it's not that people are all showing up to work drunk. I mean, like, that's not the issue. And that's what, like, even when we talked, because it's 10 years ago we were talking about this topic, and we were saying, like, tell us about the impact of alcohol on the fire service. And most people, even people who are, like, drinking at levels that are insanely high if you, compared to general population and compared to other occupational groups, when they come to work are coming to work sober. It's, I mean, there are instances. So Don Abbott is doing some great work on May Days, and he's finding that there are folks who are experiencing May Days or having to call a May Day, you know, 48 hour shift and are popping positive for alcohol. So there is, like, I won't say there's no one in the country who's drinking at work. There's, you know, there are some people, but most of the fire service is really able to keep their drinking just to really heavy drinking on the days that they're off, which is interesting. Because for most, I mean, and I think that's where you see, you know, if there's someone who really is struggling or showing up to work drunk, so that's definitely an issue. Or if there are people that have to drink while they're on duty to avoid, you know, being shaky and all that kind of stuff. I mean, like, obviously that's a whole nother topic. But it is interesting how much of the fire service can really binge drink, but then just be sober on the days that they're working. And we heard that all over the country.
And it was, you know, one of the things I've learned, not too long ago. And I think I passed it on too, that they had no idea. When a firefighter finally says, okay, I want to detox. I want to get through this, get past this. The typical person to detox is usually 3 to 5 days. For firefighters, it's like 7 or 9 days. Because they're so used to, like, it actually takes a while because they're used to not working or working their shift and not having any alcohol. And it's shortly after that, they start getting their cravings and everything, and they know it's time to drink. There's that built-in delay, though. So instead of just it being instant, we have that delay, and then we start. So it's just that we're completely, just like everything else, and you know this more than anybody, that we are just unique when it comes to so many different things.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you can't be on the job for years and not have, I mean, so much about addiction and all those types of things are about, like, triggers and behavioral reinforcements. And it's just so set up different for the fire service than most groups. I mean, even, like, back to the sleep thing and shift work, you know, when the early studies came out on shift work or the early, like, reports came out, it was looking at, because there wasn't research on firefighters, it was looking more at, you know, residents or physicians, things like that. But even that is just like a different animal. So they're working shift work and they're up at night. But fire service, you know, you can sleep sometimes and not all the, you know, I mean, like, and then it's within each department, it's different within each station, within each department, it's different, you know, you've got the busy house and you have the retirement house and you have that. So it's just, I think it's a lot. I mean, that's the fun part of studying the fire service is you have to ask every question a million different ways. But that's also the hard part of studying the fire service. You have to ask every freaking question a million different ways.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But it is interesting. And I mean, so much about, you are right, because so much about addiction is just what's reinforced in the environment and that, you know, you get cravings at certain times for certain reasons, and kind of trying to navigate all that is interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk about another subject that's obviously been, I mean, everywhere. You can't avoid it. And I know you were telling me that you've done lots of work on it recently. How about, let's talk about that magical world of COVID.
I thought you were going to say politics.
You're so excited.
I don't want to talk about that.
No politics on APS Radio.
No, I am perfectly fine with that. No. So, okay. And you say that you see me getting excited. I will say, from like a personal, is a like, As a person living in this world with a family in this world, I feel awful for everything that's happening. Like, this pandemic is horrible. It has these, you know, really like significant negative impacts. And so I'm not all excited about it on that front. as a scientist, this is like amazing. Like, it's freaking heyday. This would be like if you went to hear me out. Like, this is like if you went to the biggest, worst fire you could ever imagine that you got to fight, like most amazing, like 77 alarms. But you, like, it is sad that people are in danger, but this is the coolest thing ever. Not cool in like a, I'm excited people are getting sick.
I get what you're saying.
But in terms of like the most complex, like you get to like be command on the coolest fire you've ever fought. That's what this is like for me. But and for other scientists, because I think it's so cool. One, I think what's amazing is how fast the data is coming out compared to like it used to take 2 years to get something published. Now, like JAMA, New England Journal of Medicine, like the big like. I published one time in JAMA so far, and it was like we went back and forth for months on like this change and this change. Now, like they're publishing data that was collected last month. Like the speed of change on that's fantastic. So yeah, we just got funded on a project. Assistance to Firefighter Grants has a under Fire Prevention and Safety has this research and development like tiny little pot of money over there. But they've done awesome stuff with it, like, and so many dedicated scientists that are looking into topics in that area. But we just got funded to do some research on COVID and to do kind of like a combination, so an ethnographic study to look at kind of how is this evolving in the fire service, how is it impacting people. We just had our first stakeholder call, and it was really cool to hear the different perspectives about like places where it hit early versus places where it hit late and what resources were needed, because like this likely, given globalization and ease of travel and that kind of stuff, will likely not be the last pandemic that we have to deal with. And so looking at like one, from an ethnographic approach, how can you address those things? But then also with a piece of like community based participatory research, like how can we impact and what things can we provide as a research community to those departments now? We're also doing a piece that's a financial and economic piece. So we're working with an economist that just joined our team and looking at how it's impacted the finances of fire service, because obviously hugely impacted. Then we're also following up with we have a study we did a few years ago on a behavioral health, and we have like 3 years of behavioral health data. So we're going to be able to look pre-COVID at mental health impacts and post-COVID and look at like where their predictors of who handled it, the stressors well or who didn't handle the stressors well. How do you build resilience around specifically, you know, this type of, because this has been a stressor that's unlike any other stressor in our history, right? So looking at those types of things, and then also looking at, we're working with Lori at the International Public Safety Data Institute and looking at shifts in calls. So, you know, we know that worked with some groups that put out some publications early on about, you know, people were like, there were less car accidents when there's stay at home orders, obviously, because less people are out in their cars. Like, but then she looked at like the shifting, which was pretty cool, about like where calls are being responded to and those types of things. What we're going to start looking at is doing a, what's the word for it? It's a special kind of data analytics where you do like word processing, data analytics type stuff. And you look at, we're going to look at the shifts in types of calls. So we've seen, again, not excited about this on a personal level, very tragic on a personal level, scientifically fascinating to look at the shifts in calls, like opioid overdoses, because people didn't have access to their prescription medications. And so how did that adjust, and how did that lead to more overdoses? How it looks like we're seeing some upticks in things like domestic violence calls and, you know, those types of things where people are home. I mean, it makes sense. I mean, think of the number of people, you know, getting divorced right now. I don't know if it's just me, but I feel like there are a lot of people going through that right now. So like shifts in those types of things. And then in turn, how does that affect the fire service? Like if you're responding to domestic violence calls or child abuse calls or, you know, something like that, is that having an impact if you're seeing that? So we're going to be able to, like, that is an empirical question if I've ever heard one. So that's what we're looking at next, which I again, is very tragic. But on a professional side, it's also very exciting. There is some good. That's the silver lining.
How long do you think before you actually have some information that you'll be able to pass on to all of us?
So we actually are starting, kind of with the qualitative piece, and probably we're going to start collecting that about in January, because we've really like played around with timing, because you don't want to ask it too soon because we're still like seeing. So I think we're going to wait till we're kind of into this spike so we can get the latest and we can ask, we don't have to go back and re-ask some of the questions. So we're thinking about our last stakeholder call, we were thinking about after the first of the year. So we'll be able to see kind of that, follow some of the spikes, but man, this looking at the data on where we're headed this fall and winter is, oh, my county had to redo the chart because it was because it didn't go up high enough. And then the next day they had to redo the chart again because our incidence rate was so high. I mean, my county's going like it's stupid how bad we're doing. But yeah, so we're looking at after the first of the year, and then we're also looking to try to get that out as fast as possible. So instead of like waiting for all the peer-reviewed publications and that kind of stuff, I mean, we will publish in the peer-reviewed literature, but we're going to try to get some stuff out faster than that too. So, and trying to ramp up in coordination with that and in response to kind of what we're seeing with, you know, not being able to do as much, you know, presenting and that kind of stuff. We're really going to work on ramping up, getting stuff out in smaller usable chunks. So through like social media, we're working on, you know, getting our studies as they're published more readable for the fire service. So that kind of stuff too.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So after the first of the year, I would say. The expectation for speeding up response to this is also, it's not uncommon. You see data that's published, you know, 5 years after it's collected, because it takes forever. Like you got to analyze and clean and then reanalyze. But this is like, you just have to work faster now. So we're going to work fast.
Do you have more help for this than you usually would because of the timeliness?
We do. Yeah. We added a few other people on to the team, and then we're doing a lot of partnership with other groups just because we're trying to collect a lot up front and get as much out. Because, you know, and then the other challenge with COVID with the fire service has been like, what are best practices? And then also on top of that, I had a great conversation with the chief the other day where he's like, there are some things that we never thought about before that we should keep on. Like even once COVID subsides, I mean, his example was, he said, you know, we never used N95 masks. He's like, when this hit, we were like, do we even have any of those? And we had some like stored somewhere. And he goes, you know, we should be tracking like the flu, and we should be not exposing our folks to the flu. So maybe there are other mitigation strategies that we should use for other things. On the behavioral health side of this, because there's been a lot of talk about like how you take care of yourself, how you take care of your family when you're in this really unique situation. But probably there are some things that should be provided in non-pandemic times. And then also on the side of like the telemedicine and that kind of stuff, are there ways that you can adjust what calls you go into, or who's going into a call? If you're going into a call where you think someone is likely infectious, does everyone need to go in? Or, you know, like, it's just how are different departments shifting stuff, and how, you know, how are you testing, or are departments testing their folks? How is that set up? What information do departments need? And is that information that they should have had all along about different, you know, either the next pandemic that comes or even flu? Like there is, I do appreciate that there's increased awareness about how dangerous the flu can be. Obviously, like the infection rate's not as high as it is for COVID, but like that's probably something that your department can be looking at. And if you can kind of track some of those things coming in and work with the health department, could you decrease, you know, illness and absenteeism and presenteeism, you know, where people are coming to work sick? Could you decrease that in general? Like those are all kind of some key takeaways too. So, and then just best practices. Frank Lito's went on our team, and he's doing a great job of kind of keeping us focused on, you know, the impact of some of the shifts in terms of what people are seeing and the challenges of what they're seeing. But, you know, he was like, I'd love to see what other departments are doing. And, you know, I always feel like Frank is doing everything, you know, I mean, he's so dedicated to everything he can do health and wellness wise at, and especially with behavioral health up at FDNY, that he talked about it as having such an impact. And he says, you know, this is, you know, he sees this as mental health wise impactful, like 9/11 was. Like, it's just a total, you know, overwhelming type of thing. So how can, you know, how can we package what's worked for some places and move them over to other places? I mean, you can see I get very excited about this.
Yes.
maybe too excited, but I'm only excited about this in like a professional way. In a personal way, again, tragic, awful, awful, awful.
It made me think back to when I was with you last year and I let you introduce me at a conference, and I gave you a free rein to tell a story, and you shared a story, and I completely forgot about it. But it was completely perfect for what you just went through. That
back when you said that you think I'm normal sometimes. No, so I'll tell it. So we're in. This is the first time. So we just left this big meeting, and Jim was going to drive me to the airport. And we're just, you know, like we'd had dinner together and stuff like that, but we start talking and he's like, so you asked some random question. I don't remember what it was about. And I just got like, it was some, like my response could be like totally data driven. And I was like, so there's da 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 da. And he just started laughing at me. And, remember, you start laughing at me and I go, what? And I'm like, did I misquote a study? And you go, you seem so normal. And then you get on these topics and I like forget that you're smart. Jerk.
It's true.
You talk like you're so smart.
It's still true to this day. As
no,
now our audience can attest. Like, she actually is pretty normal. Like, you could talk about whatever. Nothing, no new pop culture stuff. That doesn't work well.
No,
but anything else,
no, that I don't know.
Normal, but then like, it's like a switch. You flip. And she'll start quoting studies and everything else.
So what's funny is when I used to do, back into some of our early like epi studies, you know, we'd spend a lot of time just hanging out in fire stations, consenting participants and stuff like that, and got great data from it. But I would get that a lot. And the number of people who have said, like, you know, you really don't seem that smart. Or they would go, you have a PhD. You don't seem smart enough to be a doctor. And I'm like, and because I'm not cussing today, which I made a note on to myself that I'm not allowed to cuss, I won't say what I did say to them. But I was like, thanks. And they're like, no, I mean it like as a compliment. And I'm like, I don't seem smart as a compliment. And they're like, no, just like you seem like a normal person. Like, I am a normal person. I just happen to be someone who can apparently appear smart if I want to. That's all right.
It's okay.
It's all right.
Let's talk about something else that is going to get you excited. That's going to get our audience like worried, not worried, but going, it's going to make them sad. I want to talk about, let's talk about firefighters and reproductive stuff. Reproductive issues.
Oh, that's where I thought you were going. But then I was like, oh, it's going to make them sad. What are we,
well,
are
it is
talking
sad.
About dead puppies?
Well, no, because no, it is, this is sad. I think what you're going to talk about, I think, is screwed up. Like, for firefighters, I think we all have the attitude of do whatever to me, like, I'll take it, I'll deal with it. And
yeah,
but like, leave my kids alone and my family alone, like, that's should be off limits. But the stuff that I know you're going to talk about doesn't really say that.
I thought you were going to say, let's talk about sperm, was where you were headed with that, which is what we're going to eventually end up at. But
that probably have been easier than what I said. I know you're going to get excited. Let's talk about sperm.
Okay, so again, tragic on the health side. But so, Yeah. So there's some stuff. So we looked at, because there's been a lot of questions around women in the fire service and like risks to reproductive health. And was that my family members looking in? I told them, leave me alone. But so there have been like looking at reproductive health.
They heard
health
the sperm
concerns.
Word.
And they're like, what? Again? That has created a lot of interesting conversations as well. When I'm like, oh, I had the most interesting meeting about talking to people about sperm. And my husband's like, no. no. So what we found, so the question around, we had started with women in the fire service. There's been a lot of question around like reproductive health of women. So worked with a lot of great groups. Jeff Burgess's group out of Arizona has been looking at, like, he was studying the safety of breast milk and things like that. So we did a large survey looking at women's health in general. And some of the most, like, startling findings were around things like high rates of miscarriage among women in the fire service compared to general population. And it's because we ask questions a little bit a different way than the other surveys out there, like an exact increased risk. We can't do like an apples to apples comparison, but we do know that it was higher. I'm looking pretty much across studies and somewhere in the range of double, if not more than that, for rates of miscarriage across pregnancies. Jeff, in case anyone's interested, has looked at the safety of breast milk. He did that in a small pilot trial initially, and he was still showing increases at 72 hours of carcinogen exposure. And so initially suggested pump and dump for 72 hours, repeated the study thinking, you know, maybe that with a larger sample, thinking maybe that was just kind of an artifact of whoever it was that he collected data from, still showing as long out as we tested, which was the 72 hours, was still showing increased carcinogens in the breast milk at 72 hours. So definite risk there. But that then also has sparked some conversation, that and some conversations with people about like, hey, are there effects to children of firefighters from exposures? So there's a couple different ways to think about it. There's, you know, just the, you know, do you come home with carcinogens on your body and then you're, you know, if you're not showering at the station or washing your clothes at the station, are you bringing carcinogens into your car for volunteer firefighters? I mean, I grew up with dad's bunker gear in the back of his Ford Explorer and it never didn't smell like smoke. So if it smells like smoke, there's carcinogens present, basically. So there's that kind of exposure. But then there's been this increasing focus on, is there an effect for reproductive health for men? Is there an effect for offspring? And so we proposed a study. It wasn't funded, although, you know, you have to often propose these things several times before something gets funded. But looking at BYU, Tim Jenkins is studying sperm epigenetics and looking at the impact of exposures on sperm. And there's some evidence to suggest, not in the fire service yet, but there's some evidence to suggest that there might be an impact for maybe higher rates. We're hypothesizing higher rates of things like attention deficit, autism spectrum disorders, things like that. There was a study or an EFO report that was done out of Washington that found there was a group of firefighters who had a high rate of cancer in their kids. And so there was a question around, I mean, the rate was high in that group. Now, is that generalizable? Do we know? We'd have to have a really large sample because, you know, childhood cancer is pretty rare. But there is some question around, do we see increased risk for negative child health outcomes? There was a study out of, I think it was out of the Netherlands. It was a group of Nordic firefighters, I believe. I could be wrong about that, but they looked at fertility treatments, and they found when they took firefighters out and compared them to other occupational groups, firefighters, male firefighters, were 46% more likely to be getting fertility treatments than other careers. So it does look like some of those exposures, whether it's heat, whether it's carcinogen exposure, whether it's shift work, because you see fertility issues with shift work because of those interrupted circadian rhythms, or a compilation of all of them, is hard to know, but you did see an increased risk for, we are seeing, I guess I should say, increased risk for these things among firefighters compared to general population at this point. Yeah. So we don't know. I mean, it's an empirical question. It's not good news. Although I will say you can spice up a presentation when people are starting to, you know, get glazed eyes when they're talking about reproductive health. And then you're like, let's talk about your sperm. It gets people paying like close attention to what you say. It is a showstopper.
I think I'm just going to start opening up conversations like that.
Let's talk about your sperm. So it's interesting, though. I did talk to Dr. Jenkins, you know, the researcher at BYU, and he said, I said, how does that go over at, because that's his job. He studies sperm epigenetics like full time. Mm-hmm. And I said, how does that go over? And he goes, it makes for some awkward dinner conversation. It usually stops the conversation. Like, because like people ask me, like, what do you do? Like, oh, I study firefighter health. And they're like, oh, tell me more about that. What does that mean? Yeah, he's like, yeah, when I say I study sperm, it usually not many places to go after that.
I make that kind of joke too when I talk about I never knew I was going to say scrotum so much.
Right. Well,
and I got to say it all the time with a straight face.
Yeah. One of the postdocs that works with us, she was like, I can't, because we had to, you know, we asked a question with some recruits, like, actually, so it was really funny. We had just done this focus group with the department. It was a group, new recruits, they all looked like babies to me. They just seemed so young. But one of the questions that the research team had in designing it was how much, like, what type of reimbursement or, like, you know, stipend would you need to give to get people to donate their sperm at different points in time? So before they were ever exposed to a fire and then after they were exposed to a fire. So I said, I'm, you know, doing a focus group with a couple of new recruit classes next week. Let me ask them. So we do our survey, our focus group, ask all these questions and gave them t-shirts. We have these like nice Tribland t-shirts that we give as thank yous for participating in our studies as a incentive. And I said, you know, what would it take? So I said, okay, so this is a different conversation, but we have another study coming up. And I told the team that I would ask so we can, you know, we're trying to figure out budget. And I go, so here's the study that we're doing. I start talking about sperm. Well, first of all, the postdoc that was with me, like her eyes, she goes, I can't believe you said sperm in front of a big group of people. And I'm like, I mean, like I'm saying it in a scientific way. Like I'm not just like, hey, let's talk about your sperm. But she was bright red. We found that there's a whole list of words that she feels very uncomfortable saying. So now we find ways to, you know, introduce them into everyday conversation. Like, well, you know, in the uterus, she turns bright red, and that's not cussing. That is actually a body part. But this guy in the back, he was so straight faced, stands up, raises his hand. And I'm like, yeah, I'm like, you know, yeah. Would you, cause the team's like, do you give like typically like $100 or, you know, like it seems weird to pay for sperm, but that's not really what you're doing. So this guy stands up in the back and he goes, ma'am, I would say that, these t-shirts are really nice. Maybe another t-shirt. And I'm like, you give me sperm for a t-shirt? All right. Came on. So I got to report that back to the team and we were able to fit that into the budget quite nicely. So apparently that's the going rate for,
I think, well, service recruiters. I was going to say, I think he took advantage of that.
They're really nice t-shirts.
Well, no, it could have been something probably a little bit cheaper even. Like it could have been like,
you think like a challenge coin?
Here's a Snickers.
You know, yeah,
Klondike,
I mean,
Klondike bar. What would you do for a Klondike bar? I would give you my sperm.
Then you have to keep those frozen. That'd be a pain.
The sperm or the Klondike bar?
This has gone south fast.
Let me ask you this.
Stop, because yeah. I actually have some other jokes, but I'm not going to share them. You see how well I'm behaving today?
You are on the best behavior. She is. Which is surprising, like, because when you do talk, like when you're live, like they do, like if they don't know you, they think you're prim and proper, and then you start just like throwing them out there, these words, and it's like, whoa. And it's they just look at you differently. Like, she's, again, she's smart, but yet she's normal.
She has a potty mouth.
She's one of us.
I try. Sometimes I go through periods where I'm trying not to cuss as much, and I just am not very good at it. It's not in my skill set.
It's how you deliver things. You just can't say it, but if you use it sparingly, it's more impactful, right?
Yes. Well, I mean, sometimes that's just like the appropriate word for the situation, you know?
Sure.
I try not to like use it all the time, but sometimes you just like, you want to, there's a study on that actually, but yeah.
You would know a study about that. Let me ask you this about studies. Hold on. Before we even do that, I just want to ask you this because I thought of it. Do you have a wish list of things that you want to study that you haven't got to? I mean, because you're now hitting these areas that have just, I don't want to say ignored, but they haven't had the attention to it that they should have. There was more stuff, I guess, that was in a bigger scheme of things that had to get figured out. And now we're working on all this other stuff, like the reproductive stuff is huge. What's your wish list?
My professional bucket list.
Yeah,
that's what
sure.
I like to call it. Yeah, I have a whole list of things. So some of my on my list. One, like the next thing I want to really dig into is the sleep stuff, because we know, like, we have some foundational work from awesome groups that have done, like, you know, we know high rates of sleep apnea and that kind of stuff. But I think the sleep and trying to measure sleep is like, that's definitely on my list. Another thing that's on my list, and this is kind of a big thing, so in terms of like how I will get there, I don't know. But I think we need to do better about measuring behavioral health in the fire service, because so often, so like you think about behavioral health and what the concern is in the fire service, we talk about post-traumatic stress disorder or post-traumatic stress injury. But if you look at what those like actually are in the fire service, typically when you measure them, like DSM-5 looks at, so the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which tells you like, here's what meets diagnostic criteria for PTSD. It typically asks about a traumatic experience someone has been exposed to. Now, I understand that the new version or the newer version coming out will talk about like repeated exposures, but it's not exactly that. Like, people aren't having a flashback. Sometimes they are. So, you know, sometimes there's like that acute experience. But for the most part, people talk about having flashbacks to like their worst calls, and they have like their 10 worst calls, or they have their, you know, people talk about, you know, seeing someone that they had coded, or, you know, when they walk, they're walking down the street and they'll see kind of like a flash of something, and it brings up like all that stuff that's coded in your mind. I want to do a better job of defining what that is and measuring it, because I think sometimes we don't see exactly the relationship we expect between variables, and I think it's because we haven't asked the right question. I'd also like to have a better measure of like sleep, because most of the stuff that's out there, like, we altered the excessive daytime sleepiness scale to ask how about on duty and off duty, but it's just different for the fire service, right? Because it's, you know, it asks questions like, do you wake up in the night? Well, yeah, if I had 9 calls last night, I woke up. But we don't ask, in the absence of having a call, do you wake up? So I think some of them, like, and it's a total like nerd answer, but we need to have some psychometrically validated measures that do a better job of measuring the things that we want to ask. So I want to develop some measures. I want to be able to look at, you know, can you develop measures that are better predictive of outcomes, because then I think once we're able to measure it, we're able to know like exactly what touch points we can intervene on. So that's a big one. And started conversations about that. It's just, I mean, that kind of stuff, that kind of work is hard and expensive to do. But I also really want to dig into women's health and women's behavioral health, and like really getting in on the topics around diversity and inclusion, and looking at, you know, one of the big questions that, I would say one of the criticisms, like, we did a study where we looked at behavioral health in women, and you do find across the board, if you just look at women in general, higher rates of things like anxiety, depression, that type of thing, which I was like, I did a lot of interviews with a lot of women and a lot of focus groups. And this is like a uniquely strong group of women that end up in the fire service. So it wasn't like gelling with the qualitative data. So we did a study where we looked at, we divided into tertiles, the experiences of discrimination and harassment. I realize what you're saying about really sounding nerdy, but it was so cool because the data on it was awesome. So we looked at low, medium, and high levels of discrimination and harassment and stratified it that way and then looked at those variables. And we found like almost just this beautiful data that showed the women who were experiencing depression and anxiety and post-traumatic stress, like almost like it was like a linear relationship where the more you experience, the worse your outcomes were. So the women who were brought into departments and treated poorly, like 49% of them, 49.5% of them, I think, were experiencing in the clinic, were reporting being in the range of concern for, I think, depression and anxiety, something like that. The low end of the scale was like almost point on where men in the fire service are. So it's like if you bring women in and you treat them very poorly, they are going to have very poor outcomes. If you bring them in and you treat them like you treat them well, you don't treat them, you don't discriminate or harass, you don't bully them.
Sure.
They actually are no more or less screwed up than men in the fire service, which is like always relative.
Hey, you're no less screwed up than us.
Right.
We made it.
I say that with love, but we also saw the same thing for physical health. Like they were more likely to be injured and more likely to report sick days and those types of things. So it's like, it has a very significant mental health impact and physical health impact. So where we really weren't, like our first study on that was like, let's just start to kind of get the same assessments. They tended to be a really healthy group. Rates of obesity were lower than the general population, lower than women in other occupational groups, lower than men in the fire service. Tended to be really fit in different ways often than men, but really fit. And so I think, so that kind of led on to, okay, so let's talk about like diversity and inclusion and treating people well and making sure that people understand that, you know, ostracizing someone from the group, whether intentionally or not. And I think we're going to see this for men. We have a survey out there right now, but we haven't collected it. We haven't analyzed it yet. I think we'll see the same thing for men. Like so much of what's protective about the fire service is what happens around the kitchen table, right? Or in the day room or in the, you know, sitting on the back of the rig. And I think we now have the empirical evidence to support that if you rob people of that, it has a very real and measurable impact on mental health and physical health. So that's the, kind of a next area that I want to go into. But we talked, so we put together, like we have this, what I thought was a beautiful lead up to a training that we've developed on diversity and inclusion. And one of the first comments on it was, oh, great, diversity and inclusion, so we're going to lower standards. So I think we need to look at that. Like, what does that mean that we're lowering standards? And then how do departments, like, why do we have departments that aren't hiring? When we ask people about how consistent the measures were on, like, physical health, like, 95-96% of the women we surveyed said that those were consistent across genders. And so like which makes sense, right? Like you have the CPAP, like, and that's been occupationally designed to be like, can you do these things that you might have to do on the hire grim? So that where they're falling out of the hiring process is not, did they pass that or not, but in some of the questions and tests. But an interesting thing about some of those questions is that they don't, and we've tried to get like psychometric properties on some of the tests that are out there and have yet to be successful doing that. We were contacted companies that do it and were not able to get that data. But looking at like, so what are the questions that they're asking? Are they polling for a specific group? Are people scoring high because they just actually have the best skills or the best, you know, the best mind or the best whatever, or for the job, or are they pulling high, like, because they've been around the fire service? Like, I heard one question from one test, someone was talking to me about, like, how would you breach a door? Like, that's something you should learn in recruit school. The only way you would know that is if you were kind of like a legacy and you'd been around the department and you'd been around fire. Like, that's not something you should have to know on the test. So you shouldn't get points for knowing what you're supposed to learn in recruit school. And so then it's like, well, does the diversity even matter? Like, does it, why not just have everyone look the same? And there's some great data, and this is another bucket list, is to look at, does diversity even matter? Some of the preliminary data from other occupational groups suggests that it definitely does, and that there are benefits to having a more diverse group. And people say, like, oh, you know, sometimes I'll be in a department and people will be like, well, that guy, or with the crew, and that, they'll be like, well, that guy can break down the door. And I'm like, that's awesome. Sometimes you have to break down the door, but how many doors do you really have to break down? Who, you know, which person on your crew is able to crawl under the bed and get a little kid that's hiding out? You know, if no one in the crew can fit under the bed, that's a problem too. Like, there has to be diversity. So, and if you look at what firefighters and first responders are responding to, it's rarely fires now. So there are also, like, all these other kind of softer skills, we call them, but, you know, other skills that people need to be able to be the most responsive for on all calls. And so, you know, if you show up at a domestic violence call, maybe a woman who's abused is more likely to talk to a woman than a man. I don't know. You're like, those are all empirical questions. But those are almost my bucket list things. We could spend an entire session on my bucket list. I know you don't want to do that, but
it gets you excited. It gets you happy.
Oh my gosh. There's just so many questions left to ask.
Yes, that's true.
I always get a hard time. In fact, I was just doing a deposition for trying to get coverage for a firefighter who died of cancer, or for his family, I guess. And they said they pulled an old, the other sides pulled an article. And they're like, well, in this article, you said more research needs to be done. And I said, I've never written an article where the discussion didn't say more research needs to be done. Like, there's always more research that needs to be done. Every answer leads to 20 more questions.
I would say that too, if I was a researcher.
Well, it's job security. Hello.
Yes, exactly.
It'd be like if you were like, "Oh yeah, no, we should do away with emergency response." No, because then you wouldn't have a job. There's always another question to ask.
Self-preservation.
Yeah, totally, totally.
Whatever. All right.
Someone's got to do it.
I think our time is about up. Which is at least for the recording part, but thank you so much.
You need to get some sleep.
I'm going to. It's going to be all right. Yeah. But, you know,
I know it is, but you got to take care of yourself.
I'm going to. I didn't know that I was going to be working overtime before I ended up coming and doing this.
I know. Well, I'm glad I didn't bore you to sleep.
It was close.
I saw a couple micro sleeps there, and just thank God you're not driving. That's how you should have done it.
Yeah. No. I really, seriously, it was great hanging out with you. I'm glad you were able to join me on my debut episode, where it's just, I mean, we went over stuff, but more than anything, it was just cool to hang out with you and have a conversation, as always.
Always fun. And I went through that whole time without one curse word.
It's true. Now, the rest of the day, she's going to make up for it. All right.
I didn't even say the words then. I'll say them as soon as we hang up.
Yes. No, it's good. She's Dr. Sarah Janke. I'm Jim Bernica. And this is APS Radio, brought to you by Fire Engineering. So all you listeners, I'll be back. It's the third Friday each month. So thank you, Sarah.
Thank you. Have a great day.
All right, you too.